know someone who spends too long in front of their computer game console? If so, you're not alone. Last month, the World Health Organization officially classified video game addiction as a disorder. So the question now is, how do you recognize when gaming has become a problem? And what can we do for people who have become addicted? Joining me on the line from Melbourne is Andrew Kinch. He describes himself as a teacher, a well-being coordinator, and a father and a gamer. He's come up with a solution for gaming addiction called Game Aware, and we welcome Andrew now. Hello.
Hi, Christine. How are you?
Very well. Andrew, you're a gamer.
Yep.
Hello. This is a great big statement. When did you start playing computer games?
Well, I think that my dad brought home an IBM PC Junior, and that's pretty much one of the first home computers. And so I played when I was 12. I'm 40 now, so been around since they sort of came into the home out of the arcade, I guess.
And did it ever become a problem for you? I guess not for you, being the person who's the recipient in the household. Your parents are the ones that are bringing this technology into the household. When do you remember it became a problem for you?
Well, for me, I guess I recognized after the fact, of course, not while it was happening, but I was probably playing a bit too much a little bit in university. I guess that unfettered freedom that, you know, when everything changes, if you go and live in residence around your peers instead of your parents, there's definitely an increase in time there. And probably after university, when I was living on my own, it was when I played the most. And you did mention the gaming disorder criteria there. I can easily say that there was no chance of me being a candidate for what a gaming disorder is.
And yeah.
Very few people are. Very few people.
So what is that self-awareness moment? You know, like, are we loners? What are we when we just become so obsessed with this?
Look, it's quite a complicated conversation to have with people. But I can tell you this. I can say that when it comes to gaming, sure, people worry about the mechanics in the games, and some of those mechanics are a bit, they're compelling in a way that isn't healthy sometimes. And it depends on the game type. In fact, it's probably mobile games, like freemium mobile games, that use those mechanics the most, not the games that people are probably the most worried about.
Interestingly enough, from my observations, I'm a mum. I have a 23-year-old son. My observations are you're in, you know, reasonably healthy relationships, yet the other part of the relationship is always complaining about, the relationship's great, and they never kind of mention how there's this aspect of the relationship where their other half is very consumed by gaming.
Well, I mean, if you're spending all your time playing and you're not spending any time with your partner, then that could be a problem. Doesn't mean that they're an addict, but it's a problem for the relationship, clearly.
So what I'm asking is there a typical gamer?
Look, I would say a long time ago there might have been a typical gamer because it was more of a subculture, but now it's accessible to everybody. I mean, there's certainly a gaming community out there. I think now if you say somebody's a gamer, it just means that they play games. It's not like they're a stereotype or anything like that.
That's right, yeah.
And I guess one of the main differences I wanted to point out with gaming disorder is in my experience or just listening to people talk or anything and anything I've read, I've never come across somebody who is a candidate for a gaming disorder that didn't have something serious in the background, you know, like your typical anxiety or depression or traumatic, you know, event that happened growing up. And generally when people are using games as a coping mechanism,
Is that a thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's in other types of, when people are talking about drug addictions, it's more complicated because of the substance itself. But the behavioral side of it is often...
No idea.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, my gosh.
It can be used as a crutch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, like, okay. Well, I just put a pause there because I didn't want to mention it on radio, but, you know, we might go to drugs and alcohol. And now this has just been placed into that category. This is a crutch, one of those things.
I just find that, in my experience anyway, anytime I'm dealing with somebody who's really struggling to engage in their real lives,
it's
because they're dealing with stuff in their real life that's really hard to deal with.
And there it is.
It becomes an escape.
Yeah, there it is.
And a little bit of an escape is fine, but like if it's escapism so that you're not dealing with real life, well that's problematic.
And yeah,
that's going to be what sets somebody up for what they're calling a gaming disorder, which, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure the numbers are different, but I've seen basically 1-3% of the gaming community could potentially have a gaming disorder, and that's pretty low. But at the same time, there's 2.2 billion gamers out there.
And, okay.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't interviewed them all.
But what are the? But yeah. Those 1.2. Sorry, whatever the number that
billion.
You just said. One. Yeah.
Yeah.
So who are resorting to getting out of their situation and just, you know, doing it as playing basketball? Or, you know, what's the difference?
Well, there's a difference. Basketball will meet those needs better, but basketball's harder. Or going out and hanging out with your friends in real life is better, but it's harder. Sometimes you can't actually organize everybody. Or for a lot of young people, they don't have the ability to go out after dark anymore. Like, I don't know about you, but I rode my bike after dark when I was growing up. It doesn't seem to be a thing anymore. And so people are joining online playgrounds to play together. And it can be very social and very positive, but it's not as good as real life.
And apparently you can invent your own personality or character, can't you? Like, inside of these worlds, you can invent who you are inside of these worlds.
Oh, you can do it.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Sure. Look, different games suit different needs. And in fact, let me try and answer that with something that I think is really important to understand about video games or just motivation in general, because that's where I come from, is understanding what motivates people to play.
Yeah,
because,
right.
I mean, if I'm putting on my well-being hat, I want to be able to teach balance and resilience, right?
Right.
Knowing what motivates someone to play helps me do that. If I put on my gamer hat,
yep.
I want to help them, you know, improve their performance if performance is important for them, and I want to improve their enjoyment of the games, because
uh-huh.
a lot of people will play past the point of enjoyment.
Yeah.
And not everybody admits it, but they probably relate to that statement, where
yeah.
it's not that much fun anymore, and they're frustrated, but they feel like they have to keep going, and that's not good.
For results.
We can do it better. Yeah, results or
yeah.
progression or
uh-huh.
or whatever it is. And so, like, I like to talk a lot about these three basic needs. It's not my theory. It's a great theory called self-determination theory.
Uh-huh.
And so we have this need to feel competent in our lives.
Yeah.
Which is like to get good at stuff. And
that's right.
You know,
we all want to be that. We all want that. That's something that's common. Our parents want that from us.
Absolutely.
It's kind of basic, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And I mean, with adults, we probably feel a lot of competence through work. If you don't have a big hobby anymore or something like that, it's generally work or whatever you're passionate about is where
yeah.
you feel that competence. There's more stuff involved as well. But the next one is autonomy. And autonomy is that, you know, feeling freedom and control over your choices in life. So that agency. And games can provide that as well within the game. It depends on the type of game. And then the last one is relatedness, which is basically that social connection and feeling part of a community or belonging and things like that.
Right. So there's a real sense of escape, though, when we can just go, I want to leave the problems of my real world and escape within this cyber space.
Yeah, that can be the case as well. But even when you're not trying to escape, people will be motivated to play because
points.
It's an easy way to hit those three needs.
Right, right.
But if it's escapism, if they are struggling with real life, for example, or even just a little, it might just be temporary and you know, you dive into a video game to lose yourself. And then we dive into lots of things like Netflix or...
Yeah,
or
I put
knitting.
My hand up.
You know? And they're not the same thing. I'm not saying that they are, but there's a lot of benefits to playing video games, but what I find with gamers is that the enjoyment that they're hoping to get is they're not always getting it when they overplay. And, you know, it's a little bit different for everybody, and I don't like to harp on hours too much, but yeah, no. If you're playing too much, then you're not going to be getting everything that you want.
That's why the hours just seem to escape you. You don't know how long you're spending on there.
That's right.
Andrew Kinch is with us here on ABC Radio National Evenings. Christine Arnoux with you. We're talking about problem gaming. Andrew, how do you know when it's a problem, though?
Well, that's the
clinching question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't worry about that as much as preventing it from becoming a problem. So, like, in the programs that I run, I've got people who come through playing 12 hours a day, and then I have people coming through playing, you know, something completely reasonable, like 1 or 2 hours, or not even every day. Maybe they're only playing on weekends. But there's some concern there from their parents because there's fights around it, and they think that there's a burning desire to play, and so usually that's true, and like they would play more if they could sneak it in. And what I'm interested in is helping people find that balance, that sweet spot where they can enjoy their games, but also have that balance in their real life, because real life just does it better. You're not going to meet those needs that I mentioned before as well by playing video games.
In other aspects of, like, I've seen kids recording live entertainment or live situations instead of experiencing it with their, for want of a better description, through their own eyes, but experiencing it through the phones or the devices that they're holding.
Yeah.
Okay. Thinking, what happened? Where's the disconnect? What happened between seeing this through your own eyeballs and through holding the devices to how we understand how we have to engage or experience real life situations? My question to you is, you talk about the fights and that burning desire. So what are the signs that we're looking for when we're looking to understand when it's a problem?
Well, like I said, I do a lot of preventative work as well as managing when it becomes a problem. The gaming disorder criteria, so again, this is a very small population, so you'd have to hit all these criteria to sort of be in the case. It's dysfunction in real life, right? And so that behavior pattern has to be there. And they use funny words like sufficient severity, significant impairment in your personal life, your family life, social, educational, maybe occupational, and other areas of functioning. It also says that it's supposed to be there for about a year, but you can make a judgment call when you're diagnosing, and I'm not qualified to diagnose this, but you can make a judgment call to say if it's severe enough, then it doesn't have to be for a year. So, you know, they've done a good job in taking that first step, and hopefully, you know, families who aren't sure how to deal with this, that maybe they can get some help or some funding or support from the government, like it can be with other things. But on the flip side, there's been some concern that, you know, then gaming gets stigmatized negatively if people don't understand the big picture, for example. So I guess with GameAware, what I'm really interested in is, you know, teaching the big picture. So if I have a family come to a program, I'm teaching parents how to game as well.
Yeah, but
right?
So when you're doing that, when you're teaching children how to parents how to game. So I was just interested in asking about, you know, do people use it necessarily to cope with things in their life?
Definitely. So I mean, recently, I can say that, you know, quite often you'll get somebody who's coping with anxiety is the most common one, really. Or even just a little bit of family dysfunction or you know, there's been a divorce, and some people cope with that fine and some people don't, and they find whatever it is to make them feel good, right? And so, yeah, if someone's using it as a coping mechanism, that's definitely one of the things that's going to set you up to have a problem. So it comes down to, I guess, responsible, intelligent use so that you're enjoying it, and then not playing past that point of enjoyment so that you don't feel compelled to keep going, I guess.
And so we're holding our devices and we're, you know, this is something that we're used to coping with, or that we don't know why we have it in our hands. And I watch my 16-year-old daughter and it seems to be something that's always in her hand. If someone's addicted, I'm saying that she's addicted, but if someone's addicted or they've got it and it's something that they're used to having in their hands all the time, should they go cold turkey and never, you know, play a game or use it again?
So with phones are a bit different, and apps and social media. I mean, there's definitely things that we can say, you know, where this can be a bit toxic and whatnot, but ultimately it comes down to like what's the quality of the content that you're dealing with, right? So when it comes to that, it's a little bit different from video games, because video games, they're their own culture. Like the gaming community has its own culture, its own lingo sometimes. And whereas when you're dealing with something like social media, that's our culture or our personal lives that we sort of shove online and then share it in a different way.
I mean, it's interesting that you just made that difference. You've explained that difference. So how did you start formulating a solution? And where did it start?
For me, I think it started just as a teacher. So, I mean, I hadn't been gaming very much at the beginning of my teaching career. And when I was doing the well-being coordinator job, I'd sort of pay attention to what the kids are doing. And then when laptops coming into schools, more kids are playing at recess, for example. And it sort of reminded me that, you know, I played a bit too much in my 20s and just wanted to know what was what. So I ended up getting a little group together, because that's kind of what I did, so I could make a bigger impact, I guess, at the school. And just started up a little group there to discuss stuff and realize that there was a need. And so what I ended up doing was actually going to Headspace, a local Headspace in Elsternwick, and asked them if they wanted to support me and run a group for families and their kids. And they've been sponsoring a bunch of programs, I think 11 programs in the last 4 years, and they've been really, really helpful, and I'm extremely grateful for their support.
Nationally, you're listening to ABC Radio, Christine Arnoux with you on National Evenings. We're talking about tackling gaming addiction. Andrew Kinch is with us, who runs Game Aware in Melbourne. Andrew, how did you start formulating a solution? Because, like, where did it start? You obviously saw a problem that needed to be addressed.
So I basically, in my experience as a well-being coordinator, I did my best to understand resilience and understand, you know, well-being in general. And I just applied that to my knowledge of games. And, you know, I was really interested in philosophy and perspective and seeing the big picture. And for example, it's going to be different if you're a young kid in primary school or a teenager in high school or a young adult who's beyond high school. You know, there's different stages of life and different perspective. And being able to get someone to see the big picture is part of what I do. And the need to do that I saw at school, for example, was I guess, one of the driving forces to how I put Game Aware together.
How did you start formulating the solution?
I'm not sure how to answer that. I guess I sat down and you know, when I was working with a couple of kids in a group and asked them questions, you know, the kinds of answers that I got from them helped me to figure out what it is I needed to do, you know? And so I'll give an example. One of the things that I really noticed was that parents weren't aware, like at all, in some cases, of, you know, what even the name of the game their kids were playing was, or what it meant to them. And that's probably a big tip for listeners out there: is play the games that your kids are playing.
Absolutely.
Get a chance to know. I mean, as specific as maybe there's a bunch of information on the screen on the heads up display if they're playing any battle royale game like Fortnite, for example, or whatever game, there's going to be information on the screen. Learn what that means, and that changes the conversation at home. And understanding that means that, kids will feel a bit more like your hobbies are valued, for example. But on the flip side, if there's any deception happening, you know, they're less likely to try and deceive you if you understand what's going on the screen. There's a lot of value to being a teammate in a way, as opposed to an opponent when it comes to their gaming at home, because it just changes the conversation quite a bit.
Conversation, dialogue, conversation, key to everything. Look, before I let you go, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any advice for parents, people, guardians, anyone who you know, think that they're addicted or, you know, someone in their life is addicted?
Sure. The main thing is to get in there and understand the games that they're playing, like I said. But the most important thing is, you know, if the behavior is quite oppositional, for example, and you're finding that you're not getting anywhere just by doing that, you really got to do a deep dive and find out if there's something else, a more serious issue that needs addressing. Because if gaming is becoming excessive and it's masking that underlying issue, then that never gets the attention it needs. And as you get older, this is why we see probably more gaming disorders in you know, young adults, especially once they maybe move out for university, because they never dealt or learned how to cope with those things, you know, in effective ways.
Mm. Thank you so much, Andrew, for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Andrew Kinch, who runs Game Aware in Melbourne, tackling gaming addiction.